Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Omari Averett Phillips, the host of the channel, and today we'll be talking to Dr. Barbara Combs about her new book, Bodies Out of Place, Theorizing Anti-Blackness in U.S. Society. Dr. Barbara Combs, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm very glad to be here.
We're very glad to have you here. So I wonder if you could just begin by telling us just a bit about yourself.
Sure. I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio. My parents were from Alabama, moved there for a better life for us. And in my time in Cincinnati, I was in college. It was 1984. My parents were both factory workers and wanted a better life for me. And so at that time, I felt there were like limited options. People became doctors and lawyers and nurses. And I said, I'll be a lawyer. And they said, you know, good girl. And so I actually, my act of rebellion was to get a master's in English. And then I went to law school. I went to Ohio State for law school and practiced law for about seven years, and likely I would have practiced for longer were it not for one of those life things that happens. My dad was dying of lung cancer, and as I talked with him about that, asking him if he regretted some of his choices, he said no, that he needed those things to get up and go to a job every day that he didn't like. And I realized that I didn't really like being a lawyer, and so I made that decision then to do something with my life that that I actually enjoyed. And because of my master's in English, I had an opportunity to teach college English as a lecturer, and fell in love with teaching, and later decided to go back and get the degree that was respected in academia. And so I pursued a PhD in sociology, and I have never regretted that decision.
Awesome. Well, getting into this book, I wonder, how did you come to this project?
So at the time, as I said, I came to sociology, to academia as a second career. My wonderful husband, we've been married now for 28 years, and he wanted. We'd made a number of moves for him and for his career. And so when I finished my PhD, he said, we'll go where you have an opportunity. And I had an opportunity at the University of Mississippi, and a joint appointment in sociology and Southern studies. And so in many ways, it was an ideal kind of appointment because I was really interested, you know, in both areas. But it was Mississippi. And we had to have that discussion, right? We had to be cognizant of the fact that, you know, we were moving a Black professional family moving to Mississippi. And in my time in, I still have a great group of friends from there. But as I was moving through the space at the University of Mississippi, there were just all kinds of observations that that I was making, and basically wanted to know, you know, why people, the age-old humanities question, you know, why do good people, you can't see my air quotes, but do bad things. And so I really started trying to make sense of the space that I was in, the positionality that I had, and I started writing down kind of these musings, and I would share them with people from time to time, and they're like, Barb, you know, I think that you're onto something there. And so it was a series of racialized and homophobic incidents that were happening. I was there from 2011 to 2015. And I want to be very clear. I'm not disparaging Mississippi. I'm not disparaging the University of Mississippi, because in my research, what I found is that we use places like the Deep South, like Mississippi, and we vilify those. And then we, in our minds, say, that's where all the racism resides. That's where all the bad people. And we fail to look at ourselves, and we fail to look at our communities. So I want to be very clear about that. But there was something going on in Mississippi in that I found that I was both an insider and an outsider. And so, you know, my intersectional lens, you know, was just, you know, going crazy, because as a Black woman walking through the space, there were times when I felt very much an outsider. And there were also times, my Christian identity is important to me, where I felt very much like an insider, even though it was a state school. People would ask questions like, not do you attend, you know, a worship, a house of worship. It was, where do you attend? And it was always church. The expectation was always that. And so it was kind of like going through that idea about embodiment, about this deep history that I began to just try and make sense of it all. And so the theory emerges out of that.
Wonderful. And so Bodies Out of Place is the title of your work. It's also this framework that you construct during this time too. So I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit about the framework and a little bit more, I think, also about how you sort of developed the framework itself.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for that question. And I have to give a nod to when I was in graduate school, one of the books that I read that I really affected me was Nirmal Purwar, P-U-W-A-R, book, Space Invaders, Race, Gender, and Bodies Out of Place. She's a scholar at Goldsmith, I believe, is where still is. And in it, she described a way that women and ethnic minorities are perceived as not belonging in space and are seen as space invaders, and talked about, you know, the somatic norm, this bodily expectation about who occupies certain positions and places. And that really stuck with me. And so as I began to try to make sense of incidents at the University of Mississippi, and particularly when there was a mini race riot after the second election of Barack Obama. We had students who were burning Obama-Biden posters and running around campus yelling, you know, F Obama. And so in trying to make sense of that, I came to this realization that that Black bodies were not, we resided on the campus. We resided, you know, in this kind of shared space, but we were fringe. And so for me, as I tried to make sense of that, what I came to was the idea that there was a cognitive shift that happened among Black persons with the election of Obama, because for me, there was still this kind of Jim Crow order about where people belonged and with whom. And while it was no longer law, it's often subjugated persons who are, you know, complicit in making sure to maintain this order. Sometimes we do it for our own safety. I want to be very clear about that. But again, the election of Obama, not once, but twice, it's a cognitive shift about where we belong, because in my lifetime, I'd always heard people say, I'll never see a Black president. And so when that happens, it creates a shift about what opportunities are open for us. And so as Black and brown persons try to move into or more fully assume spaces and our own, you know, presentation of self that embraces, you know, a kind of cultural embodiment, I saw a pushback. And that pushback was sometimes very subtle, but in an attempt to push Black people back into a position of subservience that replicated the Jim Crow order. And so for me, the first time I used the theory was in an article that I wrote that was published in Critical Sociology, and it was called Black and Brown Bodies Out of Place Towards a Theoretical Understanding of Systemic Voter Suppression. And I view my framework, Bodies Out of Place, BOP, as both a theory and a method. So for a theory, it offers, you know, a data gathering tool aimed at creating new knowledge, because just the idea about what it is that we're seeing and interpreting some of the microaggressions that that Blacks face in society was often done through a lens that wasn't our own. And so it's the idea of using this as a data gathering tool to create new knowledge. It nod to critical race theory as a method. It requires oppositional kind of counter narrative reading, but at the center of my theory and method is a recognition that we need to focus on marginalized bodies. And so I have these 8 tenets that, as I was walking around in the early days, walking around the University of Mississippi, but then other places as well, I would write down these tenets. And it was, okay, this is how I see the world organized. And so it starts with, maybe consider this position, this way of seeing the world. And so for me, it's about, in a sports game, now we're kind of used to a playback from a different angle. And so many people might view a play and think, oh, that ball is in. But then when you see it from a different angle, you realize that you were wrong. And I think too few people embrace the idea that still today, Black persons are subjugated in this nation and this nation that we all love. And so I offer a framework that says, hey, might you consider it from another perspective? And so the tenets that I arrived at, you know, BOP theory, I say, begins with the premise that racism is systemic and deeply ingrained in society. Again, for me, too many people want to want to reject that idea. And I say, you know, let's just sit with it for a minute and let's consider it from another perspective. The second tenet talks about something that's very important because for me, I thought we as a society were really quick to say, oh, racism is over. It's only a few bad actors. And we would snap pictures of perhaps a college setting or a company or a public park. And you would see lots of different kinds of people there in the park. So for me, one of the important tenets of BOP is it recognizes that physical integration is often falsely equated with social integration in society. And just because we see physically integrated spaces doesn't mean that we have that that social integration. You know, a third tenet says that, talks about whites have a possessive investment in whiteness. And of course, this goes back, you know, to Du Bois and that claims of colorblindness, serve a purpose. And one of those purposes is to deny white privilege, to deny the existence of racism, but also to circumvent responsibility for continuing racism. And so those, you know, those are just three of the tenets. But again, as I was walking through spaces, it was about writing down how society was organized. And another, I won't go over all of the tenets, but another that's really important is the idea that racism, that I've seen a tension about, you know, we need to understand and focus on systemic racism in society. And then people will talk about, yes, you know, there have been these bad performances by a few bad actors. And so there's a tension between individual racism and systemic racism. But I argue in my theory that it's on an interconnected loop, that individuals are embedded in social systems. They're not divorced from them. Individuals are embedded in social systems. So it is a falsehood to talk about one or the other, but we have to recognize that individual actors are persons deeply embedded in social systems, in institutions, in groups, in clubs, in neighborhoods. And so we need to talk about that interconnected loop. And so in sum, for me, it's all about, you know, the ideas that I convey in this theory of bodies out of place can be summed up by in the old order, the old Jim Crow order, you know, Black bodies might be per se out of place in certain spaces. Here, it is an idea about, all right, who can wield power and who should be subject to that power. And so when I saw the election of Obama being accomplished by a coalition of minority voters, then we have white pushback against that in attacks on some of the very voting mechanisms that are most often used by Black and brown people and poor people. And so it was the idea that you don't get to decide and we need to push you back into place.
So you're mentioning pushback, which I think is a really interesting concept that you bring up in your work. And so I'd like to ask you a little bit about that. So I'm wondering, first off, what your definition of violence in this concept of pushback is. And secondly, sort of, what's the rationale of this violence and sort of racial exclusion? And then how does that also affect Black people from all walks of life?
Yes, great question. And you were a little, the audio was going in and out a little bit.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, no problem. But I know you asked about violence and my definition of violence. And that's such an important important question, because I've seen a preoccupation, a continuing discussion about police violence against Black bodies, Black persons. When I use bodies, again, it's not in a dehumanizing way. I'm just using that in my conceptualization. But there was lots of discussion about police violence against Blacks. And that is an important discussion. But for me, it was important to communicate that there is violence that Black persons face every day in our society. And that violence might be economic violence, it could be political violence, it could be cultural violence in terms of attacks on how you can wear your hair or what is proper and deemed appropriate in spaces. And certainly there is the idea of physical violence. But for me, I view violence very, very broadly. And I also say that violence occurs on a continuum from mild all the way up to the extreme, being the loss of life. And because of that violence, and it is violence in the form of anti-Black sentiments and anti-Black ideas that are an attack on Black psyche, Black well-being, and safety to travel freely from place to place. So for me, it was important to communicate, especially at this time, which much of it, the heart of it, I was writing during the pandemic, and I knew that tomorrow wasn't promised, and I wanted people to understand the additional weight that that Black persons, I'm a proud Black woman in a society that doesn't value either, and so I wanted, and I'm the mother of a black son and a Black daughter, and I wanted people to understand that. And I thought about, again, my history in English. And so some of the poems from the Harlem Renaissance that I really loved. And I thought about the poem, you know, "We wear the mask that grins and lies. It hides our cheeks and shades our eyes. This debt we pay to human guile, with torn and bleeding hearts we smile." So I wanted to talk about that, because I think it is important for people to know the continuing attack that is going on, and that microaggressions are not by any means micro, and that the cumulative weight of those is being borne out, and because many of us rather than attack others, it is a weight that we physically bear in terms of, you know, health consequences that it brings. And so I wanted people to understand that the violence that we face is not just police violence, because that allows other people to be exempted and to not see their role and their complicity in these continuing attacks.
Yes, thank you. And so one of the things that you write about is sort of how the presumption of Black criminality sort of runs through this framework and runs through, I think, sort of this rationale of racial exclusion as well. So I'm just wondering, in what ways does presumption follow Black people, and what sort of effect does it have when it comes to sort of racial exclusion?
Yes, yes. That presumption of criminality. It's like, what are you doing here? And sometimes the words themselves, you don't hear it there, but it is the inflection. There's an idea. There's a raised eyebrow. There is an idea that your presence in physical space is for some illegitimate purpose. Or that you gained entry to the space by some illegitimate means, whether it's, you know, how did you get into the flagship institution in Georgia is University of Georgia. How did you get in to the University of Georgia? And when I talk about how this presumption of criminality runs through all of the frames, there was a piece that I did in Context magazine, which is the magazine of the American Sociological Association, how ingrained racism became invisible. And I use the example of Ahmaud Arbery to thread it through those frames that I offer. And so in many ways, again, I suggest that this presumption of criminality runs through all of the frames. And it's at the root of the continuing kind of surveillance strategies that seek to monitor Black bodies, whether it is, you know, being subject to an extra pat down when you're at the airport because of your hairstyle or because your bottom is like mine is more generous than other folks, or if it is going into a store or a neighborhood. Again, you see Ahmaud Arbery there going into a neighborhood. That idea that many of the people who testified from that Satilla Shores community said, oh, well, he didn't wave. And I talk about that as a performance of belonging in the space, that they wanted Ahmaud Arbery to wave to them to make them feel better and like, oh, no, I am not that kind of Black person that you need to be suspicious to. And I ask, well, did anyone wave to him? So it's this presumption that you are there for some illegitimate purpose, or that you gained entry by some kind of illegitimate means. And so in the frames, typologies that I offer for how does this idea of a body, Black body out of place work, the frames that I offer, one is the historical fear factor, and that suggests that any kind of preemptive move for self-defense that a Black person might make is perceived. It's perceived as an attack, and so then it's used to justify self-defense. Then called self-defense on the part of those who might push back. I have the presumed criminal frame. It's very clear in that. Another frame that I offer is Massa has spoken, and it's built on this presumption that it's an extension of the concept of whiteness as property, and that whatever command is spoken. So when the McMichaels are chasing Ahmaud Arbery through a neighborhood and commanding him to stop, they actually expected they're in a truck. They're chasing him through the neighborhood. They've got they've got weapons, and yet they legitimately expected him to stop. Massa has commanded you to stop, and so the reasonableness this, of their request is presumed. And certainly in the idea that you don't belong here, you can see that presumption of criminality just in the frame. And the fifth frame I offer is it's all white space, and that white space is amorphous, and it's ever shifting. And so white space is subject to reclamation. And so you see this in things like gentrification going on in some communities. And I want to be clear that Black gentrification or gentrification doesn't always involve whites displacing Black and brown communities, but it has often, and it gives you an idea about this idea of white space and how it expands and contracts, and it's always subject to reclamation.
And so you spoke a little bit earlier about sort of the way we localize racism to the South. And one of the things I think that students in classes that I've taught have always sort of struggled with is the localization of racism and working against racism to the civil rights movement. And you write about how there's sort of been a milder form of racial oppression that sort of gripped the U.S. since 1969. So I wonder if you could explain that a little bit and also talk about how that form of racial oppression also helps to sort of erase racists themselves.
Yes. And so the first title of my book was Blackout. And when it was time, there were a couple of other titles that had come out recently with that name. And so so we changed it. And so I want to, in talking about this kind of perceived milder form of oppression, I want to start with a little bit of a discussion of what I call blackout. And so the concept of blackout for me, I define as, you know, Black bodies are often welcome in physical and social white space, but Black embodiment is not. So Black embodiment, you know, I'm defining as use of the flesh to convey certain cultural, ideological, or other messages about identity, consciousness, and belonging to a social group. And I talk about how Black bodies are welcome in white space so long as, you know, there are not too many of us. And then it challenges the idea of, is this, you know, white space? Black bodies are welcome in white space, provided we don't disturb or challenge the normative sensibilities or practices of the space. And so so I think about some cases, some cheerleaders who were sat down because Black cheerleaders in predominantly white squads who were told, well, you know, you can't wear your braids or you can't wear your power puffs or your hair needs to fit into this this particular style or ponytail holder. And so here that is an act of violence, a violent cultural attack. And so the third way is Black bodies are welcomed in white space as long as they're performing stereotypical functions at stereotypical times. And so when I think about this kind of somewhat milder form of racial oppression that's gripped the U.S. And how it helps to erase racism, there was a image that Safe House Progressive Alliance for Nonviolence did in the early 2000s, and someone's adapted it more recently. It's a kind of a triangle image that in the top of the triangle then says, okay, here's what we as a society understand and agree upon as overt white supremacy. But then that's the very tippy top, and below they have all of these covert forms of white supremacy that exist in society, but they're socially acceptable, right? And so, you know, lynching is at the top of that overt white supremacist, socially unacceptable oppression. But in this image, they talk about racial profiling. Again, these are the kind of covert, socially acceptable acceptable means. And they because we have, as a society, you know, typically taken the binary approach, well, at least they're not burning crosses and yelling in, right? And so there's an idea that, well, that's what racism is. No, no, there are lots of ways, whether it's the school to prison pipeline or Confederate flags or police brutality or a Eurocentric curriculum that ignores our perspectives and views, whether it's continuing housing discrimination in society that perpetuates the race wealth gap, whether it is blaming the victim, whether it's allegations of colorblindness, you know, whether it's, you know, it's just a joke. We try to erase our own culpability for continuing racial oppression in society when we fail to acknowledge that those things, not just the tippy top, are also supporting, maintaining white supremacy in society.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And so in chapter 10 of this book, you focus on sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity. I wonder if you could, which is echoed by a number of different quotes within that chapter, and I wonder if you could just explain what's meant by this and the danger of those that fall into that category.
Yes. And so MLK is often quoted and yet not always understood as for how radical, you know, these ideas are. And so that title comes from a Martin Luther King Jr. quote that says, "Nothing in the world is more dangerous than sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity." And that's from his 1963, a sermon from his 1963 book, Strength to Love. And so for me, I say that sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity are two sides of the same coin, that in an era where information is readily available, it is only through a conscientious act that we can remain ignorant. And so so my examination, you know, challenges readers to acknowledge that, that these are willful states, right? Sincere ignorance, conscientious stupidity, those are willful states. And it's a willful state that's there in part to make inaction more palatable. And so the role that that whites play in maintaining the oppression of blacks and brown folks in society, the role that they play in continuing racialized oppression, many people want to ignore, and they point to things like, I didn't own any slaves, or, you know, that was so long ago. And I say that your ignorance of the continuing role that history plays and the way history reverberates through you know, our current life. So think about the Central Park birding incident is one that I talk about a lot in the book. And recently we saw Terrell Owens, a NFL Hall of Fame former football player who was in his neighborhood driving to his mailbox when a white woman neighbor stops him and tries to chastise him, you know, saying, you know, you're driving too fast, and the police are called, and she makes some other allegations, and she very quickly says, what am I supposed to do? A black man is, you know, in my face. A black man is talking to me. Of course I'm afraid. And she, like the woman in Central Park, you know, threatens to... to call police, or, you know, the idea is, you know, weaponizing these old historical false narratives from history about the bestiality of black men, about their desires to rape white women. And so I'm able to trace in the book, looking at Ida B. Wells and looking at some of the insights that she unveils. And she has a quote where she says, nobody in the South believes that threadbare lie about black men, you know, raping white women. And so what Ida B. Wells uncovers is that there are two things going on. One is white women entering into consensual sexual relations with black men, but the other is that black men who and women who've had successes in business, that that whites were fearful of that competition and use this to push back. So I ask people to look at the present, but to not be ignorant of the past, and to weave that into their analysis and in conclusions about what might be going on here, and that your ignorance of it is no excuse. That, again, either sincere ignorance or conscientious stupidity, those are two sides of the same coin. And overcoming the evils of this world requires a profound internal struggle. And I encourage people to have that profound struggle, and to ask the question, do our actions as individuals and as a society align with what we purport to be and think that we are? And so that allegation of being a colorblind society, all people created equal, those are ideals that we should strive for, but I don't understand how people can say that we are there.
And one thing that I love about this work is that you use some great modern day examples, from Travis Miller Sr. to Rachel Nichols to Derek Chauvin, to really show the new order of racial oppression. I wonder if you could just share one of these examples and sort of tie it to this framework that you're using in the book.
Yes, yes. I'll probably use, continue with, Ahmaud Arbery, but I have to say that Travis Miller incident, you know, still gets at tugs at my heart. So for readers, listeners who don't know, Travis Miller was a young black man driving through a neighborhood in Oklahoma, a gated white community. He gained entree to the community because the person he was delivering to, you know, gave him the code. He's in a work truck. He is wearing a work uniform. He has someone with him in the car, another black man. They make the delivery, and on their way out, they are blocked and prevented from leaving the community by a white, I believe he's the president of the homeowners association. He has blocked them and wants to know why they are in the space. And it is, isn't it obvious? You know, I'm in a work truck. I've got on my work uniform. Demands that they give him information about how they gained access to this space. So maybe I will stick with Travis Miller Sr. because the frames that I identify that are commonly used to justify or rationalize violence against black bodies, you know, one of those is it's all white space, and that analytical frame's built on this status holder's idea of their entitlement to the absolute right to exclude others to the space. And so here we see, you know, this white homeowner who again is blocking them and refuses to let them out. And again, my legal career, I'm like, wait a minute, that's false imprisonment. I don't know the statutes in Oklahoma, but you can see he's preventing them from going on. Travis Miller in his head is thinking through all of the eventualities. And he's like, he can drive on the lawn, but then that might subject him to further attack. Again, he's presumed a criminal. That's one of my frames. And so if he drives on the lawn, tearing up the lawn space, then again, he's presumed a criminal. It might get back to his employer, and his employer could punish him. So you can see there's an economic attack. There's a cultural attack going on. There's a psychological attack going on. Another of the frames is you don't belong here. And so the homeowner never assumes that he is there for some legitimate purpose, even when he's wearing this uniform. This exchange goes on for almost over 30 minutes. Travis Miller Sr. starts recording the exchange. He calls his boss and he's like, I'm sorry, I could usually handle this better, but you know, I've had two recent deaths in the family and I just can't handle this idiocy. This is idiotic. Another white homeowner comes out and gets in the exchange. Just tell us who you are. Just tell us why you're here. Finally, we have, in a nod to history, the idea of the historical fear factor. And this historical fear factor says those who employ this frame rely on stereotypes, historical inaccuracies, false perceptions to evoke notions of threat. And so, you know, the homeowners association president and his crony say, you're here for some illegitimate purpose. It is finally the homeowner that Travis Miller delivered to, comes out, vouches for him. Again, a historical nod. But we also see the Massa has spoken frame threaded through here. And in that Massa has spoken frame, you have the two homeowners who are demanding, tell me where you are, how you got in here, what you're doing here. they legitimately expect that that Travis Miller will hearken to all of their commands, however inappropriate they might seem. For them, it's Travis Miller's refusal to answer their questions that seems irrational or unreasonable, and not their own performance. Because again, for them, they are protecting that space. So we see the fifth frame that you don't belong here, and they are protecting that. And so I start the book, or early in the book, I talk about Travis Miller because he records that, and he continues the recording after the homeowners move out of his way. And you can, in that exchange, just feel how, again, we wear the weight that grins and lies, that hides our cheeks and shades our eyes. You can feel the weight of this attack on Travis Miller. And he says to the person next to him, says, you know, should we go? And Travis is like, I don't know. I don't know if they've called the police, or I don't know if the police are still coming. And so he calls the police because he hasn't done anything wrong. But is it okay if I leave? As he leaves out of the community, he drives slowly under the speed limit because he doesn't know what's going to happen if other people are going to attack him. And it's after he gets out that he sheds a tear, right? And I pause there for a minute because it still hurts. It still hurts. And it's a pain that... that I know, that my friends know, that anyone who I know who has lived in this Black embodiment in this society, and anti-Blackness is a global phenomenon, let me say that, but I write about it in U.S. Society. It's a pain that we know and don't often share. And I wanted people to understand that when they say that these attacks don't hurt and that people should shake them off, that is absurd. And it creates an additional way to navigating life that other people don't have to bear, who don't identify as Black, don't have to bear. And that is unfair, and it takes a toll, and in fact, is literally killing many of us.
And in chapter 11, you actually take us through policy and some policy changes that you think that could alleviate some of the effects of sort of racism, racial exclusion. And I wonder if you could just explain just a few of these prescribed policy changes and the effects that you think that they could have.
Yes, and the policy chapter, and you, since you've read the book, will know that was one that I struggled with, and it was the shortest chapter in the book because, in many ways, I resent the fact that being asked to even solve a problem that I didn't create. But I'm also I also want to make the world a better place, and I want to remove that excuse of ignorance from the scales of some folks' eyes. And so just being able to say that, even in my capacity as, you know, as an academic, I've been asked to solve other people's problems as a department chair. Oh, well, what do you think about, you know, how can we do a better job in being anti-racist? And I'm like, are you going to come and solve my department's problems? But again, I understand the idea of wanting to help guide people. Okay, what can we do? And so I do have some policy recommendations in the book. I know that there's no panacea, there's no cure-all for everything. So one of the things I just suggest is that people acknowledge and those who write such policies about, let's say, in a school context, and you're writing policies about bullying and those practices, that it's different in terms of, like, bullying as a generic term allows us to mask the concept of racism. And so I want to understand, and bullying practices and bullying policies are important, but I want people to understand that daily microaggressions inflict real harm, and that the perpetrators should therefore incur real and clear consequences. So I think a lot of stuff, going back to that that safe house image that I talked about, where they looked at some of the covert ways that white supremacy is maintained in society, and it included, you know, responses and ideas like, oh, they were just joking. I want people to understand that microaggressions inflict real harm, and perpetrators need to incur consequences. And the sanctions don't have to be grave, but failure to address that kind of harm is not acceptable. And so, so one of those policy recommendations would be that they're not a zero tolerance policy in the way that has harmed our community, but there should be real and clear consequences, and we need to name things and not use those umbrella terms that make them look more sanitized than they actually are. So another policy recommendation would be, especially in the midst of this moment, it's easy for even well-meaning people to sometimes move too quickly. So there's a tension, there's a dance here. So change is overdue and it must happen. But I also think it's important that before implementing a policy, it's important to understand, to go through that actual work of understanding whether that policy is going to disparately impact any group. So I go back to the concept of something like grooming, and so if a school has a legitimate interest in a hair policy, is it really legitimate if it's disparately impacting only people of color? I want them to consider all the policies that might be implemented through an intersectional lens, and to invite that lens. And so more than anything, it's to invite the inquiry. Oftentimes the work that we do is knee-jerk to respond to something, but it is not reflective. So recently, there were a couple of schools in California that canceled their football season. There was a mock slave auction at one of these, and it broke my heart to learn that that the only black football players on the team were auctioned off by their white and Latinx teammates. Only the black students were auctioned off. And when this came to light, the black students, some of them, or all of the black students, received harsher punishment than some of the white students who participated through observation, through watching. And for me, I was like, wow, you really failed. You really got it wrong, school district. You really got it wrong if you don't understand that they shouldn't have been punished more punitively than others. And it just harkened back to me for history to think about, I guess, all of those people who packed picnic lunches and observed, watched lynchings. You know, it tries to suggest that they don't have a level of culpability either. And so, so I encourage people to use that kind of intersectional lens and to understand it from other perspectives and to employ a historical lens as well.
And so speaking of like this current moment, right, you write early in the book that this is a moment when the potential for radical democratic social change exists. And so I wonder what gives you hope that change is possible in our present moment?
Yes, part of it is my Christian faith that I just remain, you know, ever hopeful, because as an academic, I thought about the potential for this moment in terms of all of the video evidence that we have of the attacks that are going on. And so as I sat down in writing this and looked back at history, I was like, oh, wow, we've been here before, right? We've had this potential, this radical potential for photography or other videographic means. I think about, you know, Rodney King, you know, but even as I talk about in the book, tracing it back to the Paris Exposition and all of these wonderful images that we have of Frederick Douglass and that radical potential. But I still remain hopeful. And part of my hope now comes from the fact that I won't remain silent, and that there are many others who, lots of others before me that I draw upon, and contemporaries who have failed to remain silent. And so I remain hopeful. And I think of the Audre Lorde quote about our silence, it won't save us anyway, right? And so if I'm going down, I am going to go down. I'm going to tell you about yourself. I am going to tell you about yourself as I see it. And I do it in love, because I truly, truly love people, love life, and want a better world for all of us to live in. But it is important for me to show you. And so that is what remains for me most radical about this moment. I write a little bit about, you know, Nicole Hannah-Jones and that attack as an academic, and the fact that anyone would even try to attack her credentials to me is a signal to the rest of us that Black academics, that you don't even many of you, most of us don't come close to the kind of credentials that she has. And if we will attack her, then you better be quiet, or we will come after you too. And so my hope now comes from the fact that we will not remain silent. And so I am grateful that the record will reflect and will show. And we are an amazing, resilient people. I am very proud to identify as a Black woman. And we are an amazing and resilient people. And so I am hopeful about all that the future holds, if for no other reason than hope itself is a radical act of resistance.
So what sort of audience did you imagine when you were writing this work?
So I think I wanted to talk to... It's interesting because I think I started out wanting to talk to whites. And in the end, I do want to talk to that audience, but I also want it just for my cousin and them. I want it because in many ways, what I talk about is not it's just the wisdom of everyday Black folk. It is not particularly insightful. It is the wisdom of everyday Black folk as to how we are able to navigate space and not lose our minds and not lose our humanity. It says, I see you. I know that you have, you know, your cry has been, I am not a racist, or how can I be a racist? And it says, it's just because I have some letters behind my name, because I have JD, PhD, that I'm hopeful that somebody will listen. I also was always moved by the fact that the first time, first recorded time that social scientists evidence has been, you know, persuasive in the Supreme Court, it was in the Brown decision and the Clark, the Dolls experiment. And, you know, and that experiment has some problems itself, but still the potential of social scientific evidence to be persuasive. I wanted to get it written down because I didn't know if I would be here tomorrow. My mother had COVID and was hospitalized for 12 days. My sister was hospitalized for 17 days with COVID. My husband and I had COVID. I needed to know that if I wasn't here, that it would speak to my children and it would speak to other people's children and let them know, no, you are not crazy. That yes, this is a world that is radically anti-Black and doesn't even know it. And these are the ways that it operates. And it's okay, boo, I got you.
And what do you want readers to take away from your book?
I want them to see themselves. I want them to see their own complicity in maintaining continuing racial oppression in society. I want them to know better and do better. And I'm some ways encouraged by that. I have a friend that I've known for a few years, Maria Gittin. She's a 78-year-old white woman who wrote a book about her experience in the civil rights movement. And so, you know, we have we've talked from time to time, but as she read the book, she would write to me and just say, Barb, I had no idea. And some of the conversations that I've had with my friends, white friends, and some of the conversations that I myself have been a part in, I realize how harmful and how off base some of those have been. And so the fact that that she would reach out to encourage me in that way, because I do expect attacks to come too, but that's all right. That is absolutely all right. This is the world the way I see it. You have most of those people who would attack have never walked around in this Black embodiment. And so for them to suggest that they have superior knowledge to my own experience and years, lived experience and years of research is itself absurd and laughable. So I would say this audience is for everyone. I give the party example in the book that I invited a group of my friends when I was in college to a party, and they all had a different meaning of the word party. And so I realize that it may be a conversation starter for some people. Carita Brown, who's an amazing scholar, she's at Emory now. She shared with me that you write a book and it's your baby, and then you put it out in the world and it comes back to you in new ways. And so So I'm still kind of wrestling with what do I want from this baby that I've put out into the world. But the fact that it's out there in the world really feels good.
Well, Dr. Combs, we've taken up a lot of your time. So I'll ask just one last question here. What are you working on now?
So now I'm working on a co-authored book. First time I've written a co-authored book with Todd Shaw, as a political scientist at University of South Carolina, and with Kirk Foster, who is a social worker at East Carolina University. It's Black Places of Empowerment. So it looks at the concept of linked fate to understand whether or not that still exists in today. So we've been working together for 10 years on various projects. We're really excited about this book length project and just living my life like it's golden. My friends will be so proud of me. This is the first time I've laughed.
Well, that sounds like a really great project. I'm sure we'll all look out for that. And I'm glad that you're living your life. Dr. Robert Combs, I just want to thank you for being on the show today. Your work is wonderful, Bodies Out of Place, The Rising Anti-Blackness in U.S. Society. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I hope you take care.
Oh, thank you. And you are doing amazing things. Thank you for all you do.
Thank you.